Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. We have got some hot topics lined up today. First off, we're going to be sharing results of a special investigation by East County Magazine that found dangerously slow response times by the Sheriff's Department in many rural areas. The county has spent millions of dollars building new substations instead of hiring more deputies to patrol communities where response times to violent crimes are many times longer than in urban areas. Also today, Daniel Sullivan with Sullivan Solar is speaking out on why our state's energy policies are causing the unnecessary destruction of San Diego's backcountry, industrial-scale wind and solar facilities that are poised to destroy scenic and rural areas here, threatening groundwater and posing fire hazards in East County are absolutely unnecessary, this solar expert says. We could produce more renewable energy for less money with rooftop solar. So why isn't it happening? And what can be done to change this situation before our backcountry is lost forever? Stay tuned to find out. Also on today's show, hear from Photios Frank Symbukakis, who is challenging State Senator Joel Anderson in the next election. He's speaking out against industrial-scale projects in our backcountry, as well as the Quail Brush Power Plant, and he has a proposal to make tuition free at California's public colleges and universities. Learn how later on today. We'll also tell you about the latest creative tactics being used by international drug smugglers to sneak drugs across our borders. Plus, Ariel Johansson will share the most fun festivals, events, and attractions coming up in East County, from glow-in-the-dark Easter egg hunts to Lakeside's Western Days Parade, to an event where you can ride the rails through our region's scenic backcountry. All this and more will be on today's edition of East County Magazine Show. What if you called 911 and nobody came? That's exactly what has happened in some rural areas where response times to violent, life-threatening crimes are averaging a half hour or more. After we received complaints from rural residents, East County Magazine obtained sheriff records proving that response times in some rural areas are several times longer than in urban areas. Yet despite spending money on several new substations to modernize facilities, there appear to be no plans to hire more deputies to improve these response times. Our investigation began after we learned that a Potrero resident called 911 to report hearing someone screaming for help. She reportedly asked the 911 operator to send officers immediately. She was shocked to finally receive a call back from the sheriff's department 45 minutes later to check and see if the screaming had stopped. No deputy ever arrived. Another rural East County resident who asked that her name not be published had a similarly jarring experience in late 2013 after calling 911. The resident reported hearing gunshots being fired from a neighbor's home late one night. The shots continued for over an hour before deputies arrived. Over 23 shots were reportedly fired before the standoff came to an end and the suspect was finally arrested 3 hours after the initial call was placed. The San Diego Sheriff's Department designates calls on the basis of priority levels. East County Magazine has obtained public records on response times in rural areas for Priority 1 through Priority 4 calls. A Priority 1 call requires a life-saving response, such as when an officer is down and needs assistance, whereas a Priority 2 call requires an expeditious response, such as felonies in progress. Priority 3 calls require officers to respond to calls as soon as possible, as in the case of non-injury accidents. And finally, Priority 4 calls are the least dangerous, so officers are instructed to respond to calls when clear to do so, such as for an abandoned vehicle. It would seem that the two 911 distress calls we described should have elicited a Priority 1 response, given that screams for an extended period could indicate a life-threatening situation was occurring, and that sounds of gunfire would necessarily indicate a response to an intruder or imminent threat. Rural residents want to know why response times are often so slow in our areas, and what can be done about it. Our research found that these were not isolated cases. In fact, average response times are far slower in rural areas than in urban ones. The Sheriff's Department lists approximately 4,000 employees who are responsible for covering over 4,200 square miles. The Sheriff's Department operates a total of 19 patrol stations in unincorporated areas of San Diego, and each rural station covers between 100 and 550 square miles, excluding their contracts with cities. The Campo Station's area of coverage has among the slowest response times to serious calls countywide from 2011 to 2013. For example, in 2011, the average response time to a Priority 1 life-threatening situation call was over 30 minutes in Campo, but just 4 minutes in Santee, which contracts with the sheriff for services and has the smallest geographic area to cover. The second worst was not even close. Valley Center, 16 and a half minutes, followed by Pine Valley at just under 13 minutes that year. There were no Priority 1 calls from Campo in 2012 or 2013, but in Ranchita in 2013, there was a troublingly long 27-minute average response time to even Priority 1 calls. For Priority 2 calls, felonies in progress, Campo again had the slowest response times in 2011 and 2013 among all stations and the second worst in 2012 after Pine Valley. And last year, Campo residents waited an average of over 25 minutes for a response to felonies in progress, followed by Ranchita, Pine Valley, and Julian, which all had wait times of over 20 minutes. Campo was also the worst for Priority 3 calls last year with a 28-minute response time. Now, there are some brighter spots, mostly in the urban areas. For instance, Priority 1 response times last year averaged less than a minute in Alpine and less than 5 minutes in unincorporated Lemon Grove. Priority 2 call response times were lowest last year in the three cities that contract for sheriff services, Poway, Lemon Grove, and Santee, as well as Ramona and Santee's unincorporated portion, all just 10 to 12 minutes, while rural areas farther east were generally much longer, 22 to 26 minutes for any place east of Alpine. Priority 4 calls for less urgent matters, such as abandoned vehicles, were long everywhere countywide, ranging from a low of 32 minutes last year in Julian to a high of over an hour in unincorporated Lemon Grove. Many citizens in the backcountry say these response times are unacceptably slow for the most serious offenses. Now, interestingly, public safety spending has actually decreased in the San Diego region, while arrests are also going down, two recent SANDAG reports indicate. Countywide, spending per person on public safety dropped 10% in the last 5 years, and region-wide, there were just 1.29 sworn officers for every 1,000 residents, and that is much lower than the national average. The Sheriff's Department saw an 8% decrease in staffing over the last 5 years, and during that time, the arrest rate for juveniles fell 46% and adult arrests fell 17%. Could the reduction in arrest rates be tied to slower response times? In other words, are officers simply arriving too late after the perpetrators have already fled due to the funding cuts and short staffing? Asked about response times in rural areas, Captain Todd Frank with the sheriff had this to say. As you can see, most of the response times have increased slightly. The increases are greatest in regards to lower priority calls. He maintained that longer response times in the unincorporated areas cannot be attributed to fewer deputy sheriffs being assigned there. And he said, the sheriff has not reduced the number of deputies assigned to patrol the unincorporated areas. He considers the deputies in the field answering emergency calls as one of our highest priorities. Well, then what does account for the long response times? One factor, according to Captain Todd, is that the sheriff's department has emphasized safe driving to reduce the chances of traffic collisions in recent years. Most line-of-duty deaths in U.S. law enforcement are now related to traffic collisions, he says, something which has touched our own agency recently. We have encouraged our deputies to drive slower and safer. Experience has shown that arriving at lower priority calls 30 to 60 seconds sooner is not worth the risks to our personnel or the public if it means driving more quickly. Okay, but the response times are far longer than that 30 to 60 second delay, and they're much longer even on the highest priority calls, so that doesn't really address the issue. Now, Captain Todd also indicated that the department has shifted its focus to prolific criminal offenders. He says, we believe this approach is primarily responsible for the reductions in the crime rates in our unincorporated areas, especially in 2013. A key problem is the vast territories covered by the Campo Station, over 300 square miles, and Pine Valley, which covers over 400 square miles. Now, a spokesperson for Supervisor Diane Jacob, when we asked about these slow response times, indicated that Campo now has a substation and the Sheriff's Department is building a new $3.3 million substation in Pine Valley to replace a smaller substation with the ribbon-cutting ceremony set for June. The staffer suggested that replacing an undersized substation with a newer, bigger facility has got to help in terms of operations. Now, indeed, the agenda item that supervisors approved for this substation stated construction of a new, adequately sized, county-owned facility would ensure a permanent sheriff's presence in this community and would facilitate efficient operations and coordination with other agencies in an emergency. However, when we asked Sheriff spokesperson Jan Caldwell, she made clear in an email response to our investigation that the permanent presence does not include additional deputies. She said, no, there will not be an increase in staffing in Pine Valley. The resident deputies live in the community in an effort to reduce response times. However, based on the large geographical area, it will still be a longer response time than in urban areas, she made clear. In addition, a new substation in Rancho San Diego also opened earlier this year, and that may shift law enforcement resources farther east. Supervisors just approved funding to build a new sheriff station in Lakeside as well. But there appear to be no plans on the horizon, as yet, to alleviate dangerously long response times to life-threatening situations in Campo, Pine Valley, and other rural areas in the farthest east portions of East County. Meanwhile, frustration at slow sheriff response times in rural areas has led some residents to resort to calling the Border Patrol for help in life-threatening situations or seek to ward off would-be intruders with other means, such as a sign at the entrance of one rural boulevard ranch that displays silhouettes of gun-toting horsemen and the warning phrase, "We don't call 911." Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with news about the latest bold tactics being used by international drug smugglers. Drug smugglers have been using ultralight aircraft to smuggle narcotics over the border. The U.S. Border Patrol asks the public to report sightings of suspicious ultralight aircraft. An ultralight aircraft sounds like a motorcycle and may be spotted 24 hours a day, but often operate at night. If you see one along our international border, the U.S. Border Patrol asks that you report it by calling 619-498-9900.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, and we are back today with Daniel Sullivan, the president and the founder of Sullivan Solar. Daniel, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks a lot, Miriam.
Today we're going to be talking about the differences in the incentives for rooftop solar versus these industrial solar, or for that matter, industrial scale wind projects that are being proposed or built all over the backcountry and in many other places. These projects, of course, are very destructive in a lot of ways. Although it's renewable energy, it takes up a lot of land. There's certainly massive environmental and health consequences and fire dangers from them. So a lot of people are beginning to ask, is this really the only way to get us to California's 30% renewable portfolio standard quickly? I was surprised to find out that there's no requirement in California's standard that any of that come from rooftop solar, that utilities have to get 30% renewables, but it has to all be from utility-scale projects. Do you think that should be changed, Daniel?
Absolutely. I think that it's basically been written that the utilities have been forced to do it the way they're doing it. That's how the laws and rules are with the PUC. They have to procure the energy from a third party out in the desert and then wheel it in basin to the city to fulfill the renewable portfolio standard. They are not allowed to own rooftop solar power systems under the existing laws. Now, if those rules had been thought more thoroughly through at the beginning, we probably wouldn't be facing the debates that we're having about whether or not we should be doing this in the backcountry. I think everyone agrees more renewables makes sense.
Yeah.
How we do it doesn't always make sense.
Yeah, the dollar figures that are being spent on some of these other projects are staggering. For example, I read in the Wall Street Journal that if you add all the different tax credits and subsidies available for wind in the year 2010, for example, when the wind energy was being subsidized at the rate of more than $56 per megawatt or 5.6 cents per kilowatt hour.
Yeah, that's pretty staggering. That's very staggering. I mean, the amount of money that the utilities are paying per kilowatt hour for large-scale solar plants, which I can speak to more intelligently than wind,
right,
is between 7 and 9 cents per kilowatt hour. So if wind plants are being subsidized to the tune of 6 cents a kilowatt hour, that's pretty eye-opening.
Yeah, and that's certainly not the total cost to build these. That's just the part of it that's being subsidized. Of course, the actual cost is a lot higher, and higher still if we were to include the fact that you need substations and power lines and things like that. So, for example, the cost of the two substations being built in Boulevard to provide all these massive projects that are coming in is $435 million. Sunrise Power Link was $1.9 billion. So in other words, almost $2.5 billion for the power lines and the substations alone, not even counting the costs of all the energy projects.
Yeah, and that's just crazy because when you do the math, if we had taken that money and invested that in rooftop solar power systems, mm-hmm. we would have roughly 575 million watts of rooftop solar in San Diego County with the same investment.
So that's the investment in the power link alone, right? Not
that's
even
just
counting the substations.
Yeah, so just to get
500 million watts of rooftop solar. 500 million watts, listeners. I want you to get this. I mean, and by comparison, for example, Thule Wind, if it's built with the 500-foot tall wind turbines out there tearing up McCain Valley, a public recreation area, everybody said it's a giant fire hazard if you talk to the retired Cal Fire Battalion chief out there and so forth. And it would produce a whopping 200 megawatts of power. The Soitec projects in Boulevard that some have said would drain enough groundwater to destroy the entire ecosystem, according to a San Diego State hydrologist, 168 megawatts of power. You're saying you could produce 500 million megawatts of rooftop solar for the cost that was invested in the power link.
Just alone. For the lines, right.
Why is this not happening? It seems like such common sense. Why is this not occurring? What are the regulatory barriers or the, I don't know, monetary barriers? Why is this not happening?
Well, there's a lot of different interests in play. So the way
it's lobbying, basically?
I think there's lobbying going on around all these issues. Yeah. But, I mean, the 500 million watts of rooftop solar, to understand why that hasn't happened, you need to understand why the utilities can't do it. The PUC will not allow the utilities to own rooftop solar power systems. Mm-hmm. And that's because the voices of the solar industry, of which I'm a part of, have said they don't want the utilities owning rooftop solar power systems because they're concerned that they would own the entire market and that the solar
concerns?
Companies, it would be a monopoly where the utilities own all the solar power systems.
Well,
the truth be told, there are entities out there in the marketplace now today, third-party ownership companies where they own the system, they sell the energy to the homeowner for a 20-year term, mm-hmm. and that's how the market is. That's one of the ways the market's growing.
Are you talking about if you were to set up something like the San Diego Energy Foundation, for
no,
example?
No, not like that. So just like solar leasing. So they do a power purchase agreement. They buy the energy from the system as opposed to buying the system. The utilities can do the same thing, and mm-hmm. the utilities are massive corporations that have the horsepower to do 500 million watts of solar
in
San Diego County.
And what about a municipal-owned system like Sacramento or some of the cities have done?
Yeah, that's an opportunity as well. Like mm-hmm. LADWP has a program to encourage rooftop solar.
Which is probably what the utilities don't want to see happen, I would imagine. Another layer of insanity that I was surprised to learn. I was sifting through the court documents for a case last week or so that came out, and this was a group that was suing to try to block one of these big projects, and they had said, shouldn't the Bureau of Land Management, in this case it was a federal agency, in weighing possible alternatives for this project, instead of just saying, well, one industrial scale project here versus an alternative that's another industrial scale project someplace else nearby, that they should have to consider alternatives such as rooftop solar, distributed generation. And the judge turned around and said, no, they don't have to do that because there's no requirement in the statute for it. So it seems like maybe there might be some room for some new laws to be passed to allow
funny.
That
there's,
to be
there's
considered.
No requirement for common sense. That's unfortunate.
Yes. Well, that pretty well sums it up.
To put in perspective, though, the 500, you know, we're throwing round numbers around. It's 500 million watts mm-hmm. of solar power would be able to be installed in basin with the cost of just the line from the Sunrise Power Link. In San Diego County alone, we currently, since 2001, we've developed just over 150 megawatts of solar since 2001. So over the past 13 years, we've developed 150 megawatts.
So even with no subsidies at all, there's huge demand and it's growing. And it should be noted, you've mentioned that the total cost to install rooftop solar, this is with, you know, without the subsidies or anything, it's 11 cents per kilowatt hour, correct?
When you amortize it over a 20-year term, yes.
Yeah, I mean, just for fun, we ran the numbers, but for example, these big Soitec projects that would just destroy the ecosystem out there, potentially for about $588 million total out-the-door cost, we could be producing the same amount of power with rooftop solar, about $500 million. For about $700 million, we wouldn't need Thule Wind. We could produce that much power off of rooftops and not have to worry about wildfires, not have to worry about the loss of public lands, the safety problems. We have people out there in Campo that say they have stray voltage 1,000 times normal coming up through their floors. They're worried about their health, not have to worry about the property values. Studies have shown 40% loss of property value for homes that are near wind farms. Daniel, what happens to your property values if you put solar on it?
It increases.
How much?
It increases roughly $20 for every dollar you save on your annual electric bill. So if you save $1,000 a year on electricity costs because you have a rooftop system, your property value would go up by roughly $20,000.
So that means the property taxes you pay to the county or city where you live are going to go up too. So it's going to be more revenues for the county or city, right?
Well, no. Oh, and okay. The reason for that is the state of California did not want to penalize people taxes if they invest in solar. So that's one of the property tax exemptions. So
but how about when you sell the house?
When you sell the house, you're able to sell the house for a higher value, but you're not going to pay higher property tax on the solar component of it.
Will the new buyer?
No, not to my knowledge, no.
All right. Very, very interesting. So it just seems like a crazy system to me. What do you think needs to happen, Daniel, for this to change? What can people do out there if they want to see this change?
I think what we have to do is learn from our mistakes. The state of California wanted to move towards renewable resources quickly and decisively, and we are seeing the downside of that in the backcountry, and that's unfortunate.
Do you think we need any of these projects in the backcountry?
I think that we need more renewable resources. I don't think that this is the way to do it. The way to do it is the distributed generation model. Mm-hmm. The utilities and others will argue that, well, distributed generation is more expensive than putting solar or wind in the desert. And that is true if you're comparing apples and oranges. But when you take into account the cost of the infrastructure required to bring those electrons 100 miles across the mountains and into basin, and you incorporate that into the cost of those projects.
Plus substations. Let's add it all up here. I mean, you've got substations, you've got remote power lines to nowhere, and then in the case at least of wind, they're saying, well, the wind doesn't blow all the time, and so we need gas-fired peaker power plants as backup, like Quail Brush Power Plant near Mission Trails, which is a fossil fuel and a polluting power plant there that's actually contributing to greenhouse gases. So it just seems amazing to me that we're doing that instead of the rooftop solar.
So I don't think the state of California anytime soon is going to abandon or curtail its renewable energy goals. And I think that component of it's good. If anything, it's our expectation that they're going to go for more renewables. And the truth is that that's what we want. Mm-hmm. We want to move towards a sustainable future.
Sure.
The question is, how do we do it? We want more renewables. We want to be above 30%. We want to be above 50%. It would be ideal if we had a 100% renewable world. That's the direction we need to go. And I think ultimately that's the direction the policymakers want to take us.
Mm-hmm. Can we do that without remote industrial scale wind and solar projects in our mountain and desert areas, Daniel?
Absolutely. And the truth be told, we cannot get to 100% renewables by only using utility scale solar in the desert. Mm-hmm. The only way to get there is via distributed generation or, in other words, on people's roofs.
And that's actually more secure also from a security standpoint, is it not?
This is correct. So when you have tens of thousands of, we'll call them peaker power plants, these solar power systems on roofs, and you incorporate smart inverter technology. The inverter is the device that turns the solar power into power for the home.
Which has gotten better, by the way. We always heard the argument about you know, there's not enough storage, thus we have to have backup. But that's not really as true anymore, right?
The smart inverter is able to interface with the utility's smart grid, and the mm-hmm. utility can ramp up and ramp down each individual system. So you would have thousands of generating nodes across the grid. That's the direction we need to be going. Mm-hmm. Sticking to a 100-year-old business model where you have a centralized generation point and then radial lines coming out of it
leaves you vulnerable to terrorism.
It leaves you vulnerable.
Natural disaster.
There is no redundancy in that model. So we've got to get away from that. So I think what we've learned from our, you know, first run at getting towards renewable energy is there's the smart way to do it, which is not how we're doing it, and the wrong way to do it, which is how we're doing it. And mm-hmm. that is by destroying backcountry, destroying communities, and investing billions of dollars in unnecessary infrastructure.
Daniel, I want to thank you very, very much for sharing these extremely important points with our listeners here on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. And today, my special guest is Frank Fotios Tsimbukaitis. Frank is the Democratic candidate running for state Senate against incumbent Republican Senator Joel Anderson in the 38th State Senate District. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here and express my views.
We should add, we're also extending an invitation to Senator Anderson as well, and we're hoping to start a series of issue-oriented talks on the show where we invite in candidates in the different races to talk about the issues that matter most to our listeners here in East County. So, Frank, if you could start by introducing yourself, tell us a little bit about your background and what made you decide to run for office.
Well, I decided to run for this particular office last year on March 21st when the final hearing at the CPUC in Kearney Mesa was held regarding the Santee Power Plant.
The Quail Brush Power Plant.
Correct.
You're talking about the California Public Utilities Commission that held a hearing on that very controversial issue.
Correct. And I was opposing it along with most of the people in Santee, in Allied Gardens, and around Mission Trails Park.
Yeah, for those that may not be familiar with it, this is a gas-powered, fossil fuel-powered peaker power plant that was proposed right next to Mission Trails Regional Park and schools. And it was opposed by not only the Republican mayor of Santee, but by the Democratic mayor of San Diego and many other prominent elected officials. So where was Joel Anderson on that issue, Frank?
He was absent. Diane Jacob was there, and she spoke against it. Duncan Hunter sent a letter in opposition.
So our supervisor, our congressman.
So did Brian Jones.
All Republicans, yeah.
Jack Dale, a council mm-hmm. member and mm-hmm. past mayor of Santee, was there and spoke against it.
Right, and of course, then Democratic Mayor Bob Filner from San Diego as well.
And Joel Anderson was absent, so I was shocked, especially considering it was basically going to be built across from West Hills High School, which is mm-hmm. right in the middle of his territory.
I don't recall him ever taking a stand at all, not only being absent at one hearing, but did he never sent a letter in opposition?
Correct. They read the names of all the politicians, legislators that had sent letters in opposition that couldn't be present, mm-hmm. and his name was never announced. Researching it further, I found out that the same was the case with the East County Power Link that was built, that he never expressed an opinion for or against.
Sunrise Power Link?
Correct.
That was the one that Supervisor Jacob warned, was she called it a severe and unmitigatable fire hazard, and she was extremely outspoken about the dangers that that project posed to East County.
Correct. And then I went, and I never thought of running for office. I was satisfied being the VP of the East County Democratic Club, mm-hmm. doing my charitable work and going about my business. Mm-hmm. And then after further researching Joel Anderson, I realized he was the least communicating senator in the state and the least communicating legislator in the area.
Now, when you say that, in all fairness, I mean, he does send newsletters and stuff out to his constituents. When you say least communicating, are you talking about making public appearances, or how? What is your standard?
Holding meetings where someone does not really have to go out of their way to find them, to speak with them.
So town hall meetings, that sort of thing?
Correct. All I noticed was in the 4.5 years I've been in East County, I got his invitations for his Christmas party. Before they'd come in cards last year, they actually came in an email, mm-hmm. which is fine. But I didn't see any open houses advertised. Brian Jones had 2 or 3 open houses where community members were invited to go. Duncan Hunter has held some meetings, and he's gone to groups speaking on Labor Days or Memorial Days or mm-hmm. July 4th. I looked online for any comments on any issues. I didn't find any, so that was it.
So apart from the Quail Brush power plant, the issue of energy issues overall, now I know that I've talked to some of the senator's constituents out in the rural areas of East County, where these massive wind farms, industrial-scale solar farms, are transforming, you know, the face of East County truly. And a lot of them have told me they've contacted him and that he has not spoken out to take a stand against those issues either, or for that matter, for it, that he's kind of just not said much. So it begs the question, Frank, of what are your views? Obviously, you're against power plants. I know you've said that for gas-powered power plants, you don't think they should be in city limits. But for the rural listeners out there that are concerned about the industrialization of East County through the big wind and solar projects, what are your views on those?
Well, I am the person that believes a rooftop solar in every house. Mm-hmm. I have presented recommendations twice to the Board of Supervisors that are in opposition to any solar or wind farms out there.
So you have actually taken a position on record
against
these industrial scale projects.
Yes. The county has made a good faith effort to work with renewable energy. So I give them credit for that. However, they're geared towards working with aggregators, and aggregators are people that produce energy, mm-hmm. clean energy,
and then they sell it
to local constituents. So what we have is we have cleaner energy produced. However, we're not losing the dependency problem. We're going from being dependent on SDG&E to being dependent on another small investor-owned company that's producing mass energy.
Right.
What's worse with that is that that energy to be produced needs to be in farms, large solar projects that are amongst fire hazard areas, that they're windmills in mass quantities that create noises. And it's not even about the issue of risking the lives of birds and natural life. It's about actually risking the lives of humans that live in the area.
Yeah, very serious concern. Now, I've always thought it very odd that Senator Anderson did not take a stand, as you've noted, with these wind farms. You know, Duncan Hunter has written letters against them. We've seen Bob Filner, when he was in Congress, was taking stands against them. Vargas is working right now, Congressman Vargas, with some of his constituents to try to address some of their concerns about the wind farm in Ocotillo. And yet Senator Anderson has been very silent on this issue. So it does beg the question. We've looked at some of his financial contributions. He does seem to have gotten many significant contributions from SDG&E. SDG&E was one of the several organizations that he got in trouble for accepting donations that had been funneled through two Republican central committees to his campaign. He had to give those back, and he was fined $20,000 by the FPPC for that. And
To return about $148,000.
I haven't looked recently, but how much money has he taken lately from SDG&E, if any?
We all had to file a report for fundraising for the first period of the year from January 1 to March 17th. So I looked and compared my fundraising, which was a measly $5,000, to Joe Anderson's $25,750, of which $25,750 were from organizations and companies and none from an individual.
100% of it is from corporations.
Correct.
And zero is from individuals.
There was a non-monetary donation of around $47 that I don't know where it came from. My donations were from myself and from four constituents. That's more than Joe Anderson received.
Yeah, so he's basically not been willing to take a stand against these energy projects, and he's getting money from SDG&E. So we'll leave constituents, I guess, or listeners to draw a judgment about whether there's a connection there, and we certainly will be asking him about that if he comes on the show, in all fairness. Perhaps he has other reasons for not taking a stand on these things. Now, to switch gears for just a moment, Frank, one of the most interesting issues that you raised in this campaign that I had not heard before, but as a parent of two recent college graduates, I know myself and my intern here from SDSU has been very fascinated about your proposal for how to make college more affordable. Can you tell us about your plan?
Yes, I think and I aim to eliminate tuition for California undergraduate residence students.
We're talking about
in
both
the UC system, the CSU system, and the community college system. This will involve saving money to about 2.5 million students, which would correspond to maybe 2.5 million families at least.
Now, I'm sure the students, and speaking as a parent, I'm sure would be delighted if it was possible to have this happen, because obviously there's a lot of people who can't afford to go to college, or it's, you know, just breaking the parents to put them through. But that said, some people may think that's unrealistic. Where does the money come from? The state has been cash-strapped. How do you get the money to support the fine quality educational institutions we have in California if you eliminate tuition for California resident students?
Well, I looked, I started by looking at what the budget used to be and what it is. In 1981, when I first attended UC Berkeley, the UC system was getting 5.06% of the state budget's money, and this is only one system. Today, they get 2.86%. That 2.2% difference at a $150 billion budget corresponds to over $3 billion. The gap, which is the tuition that's actually paid by undergraduate students before any financial aid is calculated, is about $3.8 billion. And we're talking state residents, undergraduates that attend those institutions, is less than $5 billion, less than $3 billion for the CSU and the UC system. Now, the CSU system is running like what I would say a well-oiled machine, very efficient for the number of campuses, 23, the number of employees, about 44,000. The UC system is a little overburdened with administrative personnel exceeding 132,000 as of 2012. For 10 campuses, that's 13,200 per campus. Some of them have more. UCLA is over 30,000. Santa Barbara is much more efficient.
So you're saying the answer basically in a nutshell is to cut the administrative? They're top heavy on administrative?
There's a few measures that have to be taken. First, my elimination of tuition will occur over 10 years. It will be a 10% a year deduction until it zeros out in 10 years. Mm-hmm. It will also apply to California longer-term residents. For example, you've been here 4 years, you're attending college, you get 4 years free tuition, 5 years free tuition. If you've been here 1 year, you come from another state, you graduate high school, after 1 year, normally you would be considered a resident. Now you can get 1 year free tuition. Mm-hmm. We need to reward long-term paying California taxpayers, citizens, the parents that put these roads together, that built these buildings, to be rewarded first.
There you go.
It will also apply to 5 years of studying in combination, junior college or four-year college. We don't want to keep this going on forever. This will help expedite people through the system, mm-hmm, since they won't have to work as much to support themselves.
Yeah, my daughter was working three jobs at one point to get through UC and having to take the minimum units and work three jobs.
They won't have to borrow money. In addition, a big benefit to the state will be the money that the parents save from not having to pay the tuition will be pumped right back into the economy. Not everything will be saved. So there will be a tax benefit in tax sales revenue.
So if anything, this would be a net revenue benefit for the state, you believe.
Correct. You grow business. It's not. It's like a tax break for people, just like a lot of my other plans. They translate into being a tax benefit that benefits everyone.
I mean, you've obviously done a lot of research on this, and I understand, Frank, that your background actually is in finance. Can you tell people just a little bit about yourself and your avocation, your professional background?
So your qualifications
for this job.
I spend most of my career in sales and marketing, and 21 of those years was actually in the alcohol beer business. I have an MBA from National University.
Would you be willing to vote against measures that the alcohol industry was sponsoring today?
Yes, I think we can't look at who donates to us. We have to look at what the merits of a bill are, and we have to be realistic. We cannot be wishy-washy on certain issues. I prioritize my life. As I tell people, there's the two most important segments of our society are the under 18s and the over 65s. The over 65s, because they're the ones who built this country, and the under 18s, because they're the future of this country.
Okay. Back to your background a little bit. So you did a lot of sales and marketing.
Yes.
And then?
I worked as a investment banker, stockbroker, 86, 87, 88. Mm-hmm. I got out of the business. I got into beer sales and marketing, which my life led to it. I ran the campus bar in UC Berkeley when I was there. So it was a natural progression. And I worked for almost 21 years until my company was bought out on Anheuser-Busch, and I was laid off, and that was okay. Mm-hmm. I understood it. Fortunately, over time, I had built a nice nest egg with investments, being an experienced investor. Mm-hmm. I had built a nice nest egg of real estate investments, so I had planned for it, and I was okay, and I was just going about working my business, raising my kids, you know, nurturing them as they're going through college, and living life with my wife until I decided to be politically active. I paid attention and I said, you know what? We can do it better. We deserve the best. We deserve better than what we're getting, but we deserve the best in East County. Because like Gavin Newsom said at a meeting last week, I think in California we've forgotten, and we think that California is the first 15 miles from the coast, and there is an inland that needs to be tended to, and he was 100% right.
So you want to be the champion for those inland voters?
I want to be the champion for everybody, because eliminating tuition in the state will save money to 2.5 million families. Maybe 50, 60,000 of those families are in my district. Doing some of the other proposals that I have will favor 300,000 residents in my area, 20,000. So in the end, 100% of the people will benefit. If we don't build any power plants in any rural areas where people live, guess what? Everybody benefits. We have cleaner air.
I want to ask you, circle back to another question on the energy issue. One thing that I was pretty surprised to find out is that although California has this very ambitious and I think commendable goal of saying let's get 30% of our power from renewable sources by 2030, I was rather shocked to find out that rooftop solar doesn't count toward that, and that when the regulators are considering, say, a project like the industrial Soitec solar project or these big wind projects out here, they are not allowed to say, well, let's look at an alternative of what would it cost if we took the same money and spent it on rooftop solar, how much could we produce? Solar experts have told me you could actually provide more power for less money if you just paid everybody to put solar on the roofs. They're only allowed by law to consider other industrial scale projects. Well, if we don't build this giant wind farm, we'll build another wind farm, you know, down the road, another site. Do you think that legislation is needed in Sacramento to correct that, what many would say is an inequity there, and to instead encourage or require that the first choice should be the least environmentally destructive and the ones that will produce the most power for the least total cost, both dollar cost and environmental cost, and maybe require that things like rooftop solar be evaluated as an alternative to industrial scale projects?
Realistically, the most effective way to use renewable energy is one house, one solar. Mm-hmm. Every house to have their own independence in energy production. Usually this will translate to 25 years, and because of the savings, the time will come where everything will be renewed. It would go on automatic pilot once we do this. I think one of the reasons that individual solar systems in homes is not recognized because companies that have the solar farms tend to be a little better givers than individual homeowners may be.
So it's back to the money.
They're the ones who will pay for golf tournaments, for trips to seminars, for expensive dinners. And that's why I've said I will not take a dollar in gifts from anyone. I don't need them. I never took them when I was in sales, and I don't do them now because I don't return the favor. I try to be objective. And if you receive benefits, it's very hard to be objective.
Do you think that a bill is needed to require that alternatives to industrial scale be considered on a project-by-project basis? That, in other words, the regulators would be required to weigh rooftop solar or other small-scale distributed locally produced projects over remote industrial scale wind or solar projects?
Yes, I would even carry a bill to do that, because what happens is a house with solar panels has just gone off the grid, right? Mm-hmm. So they're producing solar energy. The old days, it may have been the thought that it's easier to track big projects because they're concentrated. You know what? The way the system works today with these computers and the technology we have is very simple. We know exactly what went where. The companies that install them, they know how much power went to each house. So technology makes things so much easier for us. I don't know why we don't use it for a lot of other things too.
Well, we are very appreciative of you taking the time to come on our show today, Frank. And we definitely hope to have you back along with Senator Anderson so that we can have some real in-depth conversations on the issues that matter most. And listeners, if there's an issue out there that you want us to ask the candidates about, please send us your questions to editor@eastcountymagazine.org, and we will do our best to get some answers.
Thank you for the opportunity to express my positions, and hopefully I'll have, I have a lot of positions. I have an opinion on a lot of subjects, and I think it's a matter of taking action or not taking action, and I'm a guy of taking action, and everybody who's dealt with me in the past, they know that I don't like to mince my words. I care about the whole. I don't care the me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
You're welcome.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This week's Destination East County program begins with a champagne brunch and other Easter events and ends with fishing and a spring harp festival. But that's not all. We have a fabulous preview of some great upcoming events all right here in East County. The Cottonwood Golf Club is featuring a champagne Easter brunch in their pavilion and spring gardens with lake views on Sunday, April 20th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The brunch includes meat carving stations, a waffle station, entrees, dessert, offerings, and much more, all on Easter Sunday morning. Saturday, April 19th is the last day to ride the Bunny Train, a real train out at the Campo Depot and Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. The Bunny Train has lots of Easter eggs and fun craft activities for the kids. Trains depart Campo Depot at 11 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. for a scenic one-hour round-trip journey through the mountains with the Easter Bunny. Advance reservations required for this event at www.psrm.org. The 60th Annual Easter Pancake Breakfast will be held in Alpine on Easter Sunday, April 20th, from 7 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. at the Alpine Elementary School Auditorium in Alpine. And for more information, contact the Alpine Chamber of Commerce. Santee Lakes Eggstravaganza and Egg Hunts will be celebrated on Saturday, April 19th, most of the day from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The egg hunts are for children ages 3 to 8 years old. Dogs are prohibited on site. The continuous egg hunts are first come, first served. Other fun activities throughout the day include Primo DJ, pony rides, a petting zoo, bounce houses, face painting, crafts booths, food, carnival rides, and games. At the San Carlos Recreation Center on Saturday, April 19th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., the annual Spring Carnival and Egg Hunt for kids 0 to 12 will be presented. Activities include the egg hunts, air jumpers, live music, a DJ, and more egg hunts are every half hour, starting with the little ones from 0 to 2 years at 10:30 a.m. and ending with the 9 to 12-year-olds at 12 p.m. Baskets are not provided. This event is sponsored by the San Carlos Lake Murray Recreation Council and the City of San Diego Park and Recreation Department. Pine Hills Lodge in Julian is holding an Easter brunch and egg hunt on Easter Sunday, April 20th. The egg hunt begins at 11 a.m. Reservations are required for the brunch, which is served from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. The Croc Hop Bunny Drop will be happening at the Ray and Joan Croc Community Center on Saturday, April 19th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Croc Community Church is hosting its 10th annual free community Easter egg hunt and festival with more than 2,000 local children expected who can enjoy visits and pictures with the Easter Bunny, bounce houses, arts and crafts, music, carnival games, and exciting prizes. This year, they are introducing the new toddler zone for children under 3 years old. Kids 4 to 11 years old are invited to hunt for more than 15,000 eggs on the Croc Center field. Ramona is hosting their annual egg hunt on Saturday, April 19th at 10 a.m. at Dos Picos Regional Park in Ramona. They plan to have 4,000 goodie-filled eggs awaiting children in three designated zones for ages 2 and under, ages 3 to 5, and ages 6 and older. Stick around after the hunt to play the life-size Candyland game. The Easter Bunny will be hopping by for photo ops and also furry hugs. Visitors in Spring Valley can have breakfast with the Easter Bunny there and hunt for eggs at the Spring Valley Community Center on Hamishaw Boulevard in Spring Valley. Breakfast with the bunny includes pancakes, sausage, juice, coffee, and milk, all served by Kiwanis volunteers. Then the entire family can enjoy a special visit from Spring Valley's own bunny. The free egg hunt is for ages 2 through 10 and starts at 9 a.m. sharp. Our last egg hunt is a unique knockoff from the original egg hunt, and it's just for the older kids. A teen glow-in-the-dark egg hunt will take place in Poway at the Lake Poway Pavilion on Poway Road on Friday night, April 18th from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. This glow-in-the-dark egg hunt for teens 6th through 9th grade who can join the quest can hunt 1,000 glow-in-the-dark eggs, and they will be filled with candy, gift cards, and tons of marvelous prizes. Early registration is recommended as spots are limited for this free event. Fishing is back at Cottonwood Golf Club in Lake No. 1 only on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Contact the Cottonwood Pro Shop for more information and to buy tickets. Cottonwood Golf Club is located at Willow Glen Drive in El Cajon. The Spring Harp Festival is a free all-day event happening on Saturday, April 19th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. This annual festival was originally founded in 1999 to promote the American art form of the blues harmonica. Some of Southern California's finest harmonica players perform at this annual Spring Harp Fest. It's a family-friendly outdoor event located at Harry Griffin Park in La Mesa, California. Now for our preview for you of some seasonal traditional events that are returning in East County in the next couple of weeks, as well as some other new ones that will be coming up. Cajon Classic Cruises returns again this year beginning on Wednesday, April 23rd from 5 to 8 p.m. This annual car show is held in the area of the Prescott Promenade in downtown El Cajon and is hosted by the Downtown El Cajon Business Partners. Cajon Classic Cruise car shows are held every Wednesday night and continue through October. The first car show will involve a full street closure of East Main Street between Magnolia and Claydell Avenues from 5 to 8 p.m. The Wings of Freedom aircraft tour will be stopping at the Ramona Airport on Wednesday, April 23rd through Friday, April 25th. Aviation enthusiasts and war history buffs can enjoy a unique display at Ramona Airport of World War II aircraft. There are walkthrough tours as well as actual flights in a few of the vintage aircraft. The 49th annual Lakeside Western Days Parade's theme for this year is Lakeside, where the West is still alive, and celebrates the Lakeside Rodeo's 50th anniversary. The event will take place on Saturday, April 26th, at 9:35 a.m. along Woodside and Main Avenue. This year's parade grand marshal is the El Capitan Stadium Association for 50 years of organizing the Lakeside Rodeo. The parade will be filled with a wide variety of antique and classic cars, bands and entertainment from local schools, floats representing local businesses and organizations, clowns, and of course, cowboys and cowgirls. To get ready for the parade the night before on April 18th, Friday night, the Optimist Club of Lakeside will be offering its 33rd annual Western Days Barbecue Dinner, served at the Lakeside Rodeo Grounds from 5:30 to 8 p.m. The menu is deep pit barbecue beef with all the fixings. The annual Lakeside Rodeo will take place the same weekend as the Lakeside Parade and Western Days Celebration. Performances are scheduled throughout Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, April 25th, 26th, and 27th at the Lakeside Rodeo Grounds. Spectators can enjoy Western-style fun with bronc riding, barrel racing, steer wrestling, roping competitions, and more. The 6th Annual Coyote Music Festival will be hosted by Cuyamaca Community College on the campus Grand Lawn on Saturday, April 26th from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. The festival features 7 bands of up-and-coming local talent that will showcase all original music compositions. These homegrown singer-songwriters will perform a variety of genres, including acoustic, folk, rock, and pop. The event is free, open to the public, and has free parking. A springtime English-style high tea amidst blooming fields of lavender will be served up at the Keys Creek Lavender Farm in Valley Center. Their menu includes lemon lavender scones with jam and Devonshire cream, appetizers, sandwiches, smoked turkey, truffled egg salad, chicken tarragon, fresh fruit, raspberry cream roulade, Viennese chocolate vanilla crescents, lavender lady kisses, and an assortment of hot teas. The high teas will be served April 25th and 26th. The 19th annual East County Garden Tour, put on by the Friends of East County Arts, Inc., takes place on Saturday, April 26th. All 6 gardens offer a variety of settings to learn from and enjoy. Included in the tour this year are water-wise settings, unique garden corners, an African-themed explosion of colorful characters and drought-tolerant plants, St. Madeline Sophie's 2-acre organic garden and nursery, which sells many wonderful plants, and apple crate vendors offering crafts and garden creations. The Wine and Rail event embarks on Saturday, April 26th at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum in Campo, and the Campo Depot, where riders can enjoy an afternoon of leisure in the beautiful backcountry, riding the historic Pacific Southwest rails. Altogether, there will be live presentations by local wineries, heavy hors d'oeuvres, presentations by historians and wineries, as well as the scenic train ride, all put on by the Mountain Empire, Campo, Kiwanis, and the East County Vintners Association. That's all for this week. All of these events and more can be found on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is supported by our listeners and with a community enhancement grant from San Diego County. See you around, East County.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.